Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan. She's the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Good morning, Anne.
Morning, John.
And expected to join us a little later on the phone will be Josh Balling, the assistant editor at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We're going to hear from Sally Rose, the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Tim Wood will join us. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. And if Nelson Siegelman, the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times, is back from deer hunting, we should hear him as well. So let's take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and Islands. We'll start with the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which we talk about often. It's been a really rough year for Pilgrim, a lot of unanticipated shutdowns. And now we read that because of those shutdowns and problems at the plant, it's now one of the nation's worst performing nuclear power plants.
Right. Earlier this week, they were placed among the 22 worst performing plants. And then a letter came in midweek to Entergy, which owns the plant, saying that actually you could be in the worst eight. And what this means is that the plant is going to get a higher level of regulatory scrutiny, that they'll probably have more inspectors on site, really trying to make sure that the plant is operating safely and really trying to come to some of the root causes that have led to more than three unplanned shutdowns of the plant, which is significant. Generally, a plant is allowed one unplanned shutdown, and what happens in an unplanned shutdown is you have to shut it down really quick. It's very stressful on all the infrastructure within the plant. There's miles of pipes, and there's pumps and just tons of things that can wear out much more quickly if it's under that stress repeatedly. Generally, when they want to shut down the plant for maintenance or other reasons, repairs, they shut it down gradually. This is one of the reasons why they are going to get increased scrutiny at the plant, in addition to the fact that there are other things that have performance has dropped. For example, the rating of the plant's on-site energy backup systems. Also, the performance of those systems have dipped as well.
Yeah, well, one of the shutdowns was because they lost off-site power.
Right.
And that's a dangerous situation. That's what happened over at Fukushima. It was the loss of off-site power that led to the disaster
there. The reason they need the power is because they need to keep the water flowing through the plant. The water, goes into the reactor, gets turned into steam. That then turns the turbines to produce energy. But then that water is then cooled again to then be pumped back into the reactor or cooling systems around the reactor. The reactor there's a fine balance between keeping it hot enough to create energy, but not so hot that it's going to melt down. And there's also the spent fuel pool, which was a real issue at Fukushima because they couldn't keep those pools filled up.
Yeah, that's where they put the spent fuel rods, which are still highly radioactive. What about management? Entergy indicated they're having some management shuffling around, as well as we heard from the union a little bit. They're concerned about some layoffs.
Right. They announced that they were going to lay off seven or eight administrators, technicians, and technical specialists at the plant. The union, of course, you would expect the union to be beating their chest about these layoffs because that's what unions do. But Senator Markey has come forward and said, please don't do these layoffs. These are people who are in jobs that I think or monitor procedures for the safe operation of the plant and what to do in emergency situations. So Markey is urging Entergy, please don't do these layoffs. You've got a good team there. They're running the plant safely. Let's keep them there.
We've heard a lot from folks on the Cape who are opposed to the plant. And I was thinking about them today when I saw a Forbes article that listed Pilgrim as one of the possible future plants to close. I think they listed about 10 plants that could possibly close, and they were citing the cost. And as we've talked about here on the News Roundup, the low cost of natural gas has made things more difficult for nuclear power plants. We saw Vermont Yankee close down, also owned by Entergy. But so far, Entergy has not indicated they have any intention of closing down the Pilgrim power plant, which was recently relicensed for another 20 years.
Right. There may be one indication in that they negotiated a shorter term contract with the town of Plymouth for payments in lieu of taxes. Some people are looking at that. But people are saying that with these shutdowns, with these performance degradations, that Wall Street is watching and analysts are looking. You know, energy is a company. They, you know, are on the stock market. And so this is something else that is playing into this, that you want a very smooth operation in order to keep the analysts at bay and saying that this is a good investment.
Let's move on to a suspect has been arrested in an arson case or several arson cases out in Provincetown. I mean, this really had Provincetown captivated a few years back when someone was out there lighting fires, and now they have a suspect in custody.
Captivated and fearful.
Absolutely.
Afraid.
I mean, look, think about this town. It's so historic, and by that I mean wood close together
exactly.
buildings. I mean, that place could really.
And a fire, a huge fire near the wharf in the 90s that was very hard to put out.
Right.
So this is Kevin James Stinson. He's 55. He's a Provincetown resident, was arrested last week and charged in six of the 20 arson cases that are still under investigation. These are fires that started in like mid-October of 2007, started out slow, you know, with trash fires, a fire in the woods,
right.
small, and escalated over time to where, you know, on November 27th, there was a fire started at a waterfront house that burned the kitchen and utility room. Then another fire in a that was in a $2.3 million home that really caused problems. And in one of those fires, a firefighter almost got killed when a piano fell through a floor and just missed him.
Well, that's frightening. And of course, that fire in that
$2.3 million home.
Okay, and then there was Cohen's studio, right?
Right.
Arthur Cohen's studio. That destroyed 13 large paintings.
Right, that was in March of 2008, and that fire happened.
It was almost like this, whoever did it, was becoming more and more brazen
exactly.
as time went on.
Exactly.
And so how did they find this suspect?
Well, apparently Stinson went, at the time of one of these fires, went to a friend's house, and he said that he was... She described him as inebriated, and he wanted to come into her house, and she didn't want to let him in. And he allegedly blurted out, "I started the fire, or I'm the arsonist."
Okay.
And she told police.
Okay.
So he's been on the radar of investigators since early on, but they didn't really have enough evidence. Apparently, somebody that same night that this woman saw Stinson, a man who was dressed similarly to how she described Stinson was dressed, had a bottle with a torch, kind of a Molotov cocktail, near a dumpster. So they were looking at him. But then last week, they had a footprint that they had taken a picture of from one of the scenes. They showed it to Stinson's boyfriend or former boyfriend, who identified it as Stinson, like what the bottom of shoes that Stinson owns.
I see. And this suspect, Stinson, was released without bail at this
right.
point?
Right.
Okay.
He's pleaded not guilty, but he is on his own recognizance.
I see. We're going to go to Josh Balling now, who's joining us on the phone. He's the assistant editor of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning.
Scallop season began this week. This has been one of the bright spots of our fisheries here on the Cape and the Islands. How was the first week, the first couple days?
First week has been impacted quite a bit by the nasty weather we've been having for the first time in a while. The high winds, the rain we had yesterday has led to a little bit of a slower start than usual for the commercial scallop season, which runs from November 1st all the way through the end of March next year. And so far, it's off to a little bit of a slow start. The fishermen having a hard time battling the winds and the weather out there, but you know, it's a long season. They say they're optimistic. Right now, scallops are selling wholesale. Their fishermen are being paid $12 or $13 a pound for shucked scallop meat and retailing on the island for anywhere from $16, $17 up to about $20 a pound. A lot of that scallop meat also goes off the island to restaurants around the region and even around the country. And Nantucket Bay scallops are known pretty much worldwide for being sweeter and tastier than just about any other scallop out there. It's definitely a point of pride for the Nantucket fishery and fisheries in general around New England.
Are those good prices comparatively to other years for scallop meat?
It's a about average for the last couple of years. I think it speaks perhaps to not knowing exactly where the where the harvest is going to be just yet. They opened last year at about the same price. Actually, opened last year at $11 a pound to the fishermen. We're selling for $15 to $18 retail. So until I think a little bit better handle is grasped on what the harvest is going to look like. Probably stick in that range. They don't fluctuate too much unless there's some kind of a big spike or a downturn in the fishery.
I see. And special town meeting was Monday night. You were there. One of the issues was talking about access to Nantucket Harbor. What's that about?
But Nantucket has long had a reputation and a tradition of providing public access, open, free public access to the waterfront, to its beaches. We have multiple public beaches that there's no charge to get onto. There's plenty of public ways that lead to the beach. But in recent years, especially as over the last decade or so, with property values rising, property owners have been closing off some of those ways that have long been open. And there's been a move afoot. The town actually has a program called the One Big Beach Program to ensure that those ways stay open, that anybody can get to Nantucket's beautiful beaches. And on Monday night at special town meeting, there was an article that authorized the Board of Selectmen to take a number of streets by eminent domain or by acquisition to purchase or receive as a gift. Some of these access points down to the harbor on Brant Point off Hulbert Avenue, driven largely by one of those ways being closed off earlier this year, spurred town officials and residents to act and to ensure that these streets stay open and people have access to the beach from pretty much any place on the island.
Was there any discussion or pushback from folks who actually live on those streets who want them closed?
There wasn't. It's one of those situations as well, as most of the property owners in those streets are non-residents. They're summer homes. There wasn't anything read into the record, however, in any opposition. I think a lot of times they don't necessarily speak in opposition to this. They just go and close off the roads. But a couple of town officials did say that they didn't want this to be an antagonistic process, that they have been talking with some of the property owners. And one of the provisions of the One Big Beach program, there is some give back to the property owners. In exchange for guaranteeing access, the town provides liability insurance. It provides some maintenance and cleanup and other benefits to the property owner for ensuring that the beaches in front of their homes have access to the public.
Okay, Josh, things cooling down over there on Nantucket, calming down with in terms of visitors and such this time of year?
They definitely are, especially during the week. Our weekends are still very busy. There always seems to be some kind of event going on right up through the holidays. We have our big Christmas stroll celebration coming up the first week in December. Thanksgiving week and weekend is always very popular out on Nantucket, especially the last 4 or 5 years with Vice President Joe Biden coming out to Nantucket. He's been coming here for over 30 years, but since he's been in the White House, it's been a little bit more fun to have the Vice President out here every year for Thanksgiving. A big big event, lots of people come out, and with the weather cooling off, we still have some day trippers, but the pace of life has definitely slowed quite a bit.
I see. Yeah, Joe Biden is a fun guy. We can certainly say that for sure. Josh, thanks so much. You did a great job. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to keep talking about the local news stories, and we expect to hear from Sally Rose from the Provincetown Banner.
No cell in your 100 billion cells in your brain.
Is it in a neuron?
Is having a thought.
If you took your neuron out and lay it on the table, could you see the bit of the thought that's in that neuron?
But together they are.
No, it's not in the neuron.
Together they're falling in love or wanting to write music. So who's in there?
This week on Radiolab, we look at the leaderless logic of ants, cities, Google, even your own brain.
Who's sitting inside the head of the person sitting inside my head?
Join us for Radiolab on WCAI Sunday afternoon at 3.
Singer-songwriter Chandler Travis from East Ham.
I threw some meat into the pond. Where it fell and who on? You don't know what it does to me to see meat sink so rapidly. I threw a lamb chop in the ocean with a swift athletic motion. You can't imagine how I'd wish to know my meat had hit a fish. I can't describe how my heart's aching to cover up that stream with bacon. This very concept makes me quiver to throw a liver in the river. For some time it's been my belief that water should be full of beef. Surely, if I had a pony, I'd not need to sink baloney.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Welcome back. This is the News Roundup, when we discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in our Woods Hole studio is Anne Brennan, the Assistant Managing Editor for Digital Media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Sally Rose. She's the editor of the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Sean.
One of the things we've talked about over the past few months is the VFW building, and it's been kind of a roller coaster as the town and the VFW have worked to sell that property to the town. Did it finally go through this week? Is that what happened?
Well, yes. A majority of members of the VFW in Provincetown, that's the Lewis A. Young Post 3152, they have once again voted to sell the three-parcel property on Jerome Smith Road, and it took place in a redo vote earlier this week. And once again, the state VFW commander who was there sanctioned the vote. If you remember, Sean, the previous vote to sell, it was held in late June. That was ultimately deemed not to be valid because the letter that was sent out to members inviting them to attend, the vote didn't have the right verbiage, the local commander told us. Some members of the Post, however, opposed the sale, and they've all along been asserting that that earlier vote was not lawful for a variety of reasons, not necessarily related, however, to the wording. And once again, if those members have their way, this vote won't stick either. So we're not sure what's going to happen, but certainly that the antipathy in the room that night of this most recent vote of one side toward the other was really more than palpable.
Mm. Any clarity on what the town of Provincetown would do with the building if it does in fact get it?
Well, there's not a lot of clarity yet. I think, although, if you remember at town meeting, there was the original article had said either for a police station or other use, there was a group of residents who wanted to change that and take out the for the police station, which was done. So it's not been decided yet, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised if it ultimately is used for a police station.
Okay, let's talk about coyotes at Herring Cove. Very interesting story about coyotes being lured to Herring Cove parking lot there by folks wanting to feed them.
Yeah, it's a little bit strange.
part of the people who want to feed them, I imagine.
Exactly. The National Seashore Rangers are now finding themselves in a place where they have to educate the public about coyotes. The rangers have said that they've seen both tourists and residents actually feeding wild coyotes. They've been tossing like fish scraps and sometimes even dog food, they say, from the cars. And it's been going on in the Herring Cove parking lot area as well as Race Point and even at the West End Rotary. And because of that, as you can understand, several families of coyotes have been showing up regularly at all three of those locations looking for those handouts, apparently. Now, with fall's arrival and, of course, with fewer tourists around, the coyotes have been sort of concentrating primarily in the north parking lot at Herring Cove. And that's, of course, where everyone goes to watch sunset, and it still continues to draw a big crowd, like 30 to 60 vehicles on a regular basis daily. And on some evenings, the rangers say they've seen groups of four or five coyotes begging, so to speak, at parked cars. The rangers are trying to do whatever they can to disperse the coyotes, but like making noise and shining lights and banging on trash cans. But the real deterrent, of course, will have to be people no longer feeding them.
Anne Brennan?
Well, I understand, too, that they cited somebody, and it's big penalties for feeding wildlife in a national park. It's something like $5,000 fine and jail time possible.
Right. I mean, it's a pretty deliberate act to carry a bag of dog food to a parking lot. It's not like you're sitting in there having a sandwich and tossing out a crust or something like that. This is deliberate, and, of course, the concern would be that these coyotes become used to people and then begin approaching people even more brazenly.
Well,
Go ahead, Sally.
That's right, and you know they can certainly. The worry is they could go after small children and pets, and the rangers are already getting calls from hunters who are warning them that they're planning to hunt the coyotes in the area. So there's going to be penalties to both the humans and the coyotes here in this situation.
Okay, Ann?
I mean, the bottom line is these are wild animals, and you can love animals and watch them, but they're wild animals, and they're unpredictable, like Sally said. You don't know, you know, what might trip them off.
Sure.
And so it's best to not feed them.
Yeah, it's amazing we have to educate the public about this, you know, but whatever. People are unpredictable, too. Sally Rose, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll talk to you later. Ann Brennan, let's talk about another story we've been following. Senator Dan Wolf gets the okay to run for re-election. He'd been under this cloud over ethics and conflict of interest. Tell me about it.
Well, the State Ethics Commission voted to provide an exemption in the conflict of interest laws that will allow people, like in Dan Wolf's situation, business people who have contracts with the state that are no bid, non-negotiable contracts, to run for office. If they previously, if you held controlled less than 10% interest in a company, you could do that. Dan Wolf controls about 20% interest in his company, Cape Air, and that's why they ruled earlier. You cannot run for governor, and you're going to have to leave the Senate. They retracted the you cannot run for governor part because they can't really tell people who can't run for governor. But what this does is this exemption. Under this exemption, officials must disclose that they have the contract before they're either appointed or they run for office. They have to be contracts reached before the employee enters public office, and it mandates that amendments to the contracts be non-negotiable, non-competitively bid, and substantially similar to the agreement predating officials' election or appointment.
Ah, so you can come in if you've had this contract already set up and already established. You can come in, you can serve. But you're saying you can't come in and start to serve and then start to negotiate a contract with the state.
Or apply for a contract. I mean, these contracts that we're talking about, Cape Air lands at Logan and takes off at Logan. So the Logan Airport or Massport Authority has to allow any viable airliner to land or take off there. There's contracts in place. The federal government sets the fees for those contracts. Mm-hmm. It's a transaction more than, you know, who can, you know, provide the cheapest building of a bridge or something. So this was the gray area. This is where Dan Wolf felt like, I was shocked that I was in conflict of interest because I have no influence here.
Right.
And one of the things that make – well, there's a public comment period that this has to go through before it's finally approved. And one of the things that's going to come out of this, according to the chairman of the board, is that they could lead to more business people being able to run for office, business people who have these kinds of contracts that – I mean, they weren't championing this. They're just saying that this may be one of the results.
Right. And it applies to state office as well as town offices, selectmen and such. Let's talk about the Falmouth wind turbine issue that has been continuing. There are two turbines in the town of Falmouth. They're both town-owned. Neighbors around those turbines have complained about health effects and sleep problems related to those turbines, and it's been going round and round. At first, earlier in the week, we heard that from the Board of Health that they weren't going to recommend that the selectmen change the hours of when they operate. But now we have some new news. It's just this morning.
Well, the health board weren't going to order the selectmen to change. They were going to hope that the selectmen would change the hours to like 7 to 10 p.m. as opposed to what they've been doing, 5 a.m. to 9 p.m. In the meantime, yesterday, a Barnstable Superior Court judge approved an agreement that was struck between the town officials and neighbors of the turbines who say that this has been hurting their health and other problems, that the turbines will run from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. This was an agreement that the judge encouraged.
They said get together and figure this thing out.
Right. And this is what they came up with. It's a temporary agreement, mm-hmm. but under this agreement, the turbines will run for 12 hours. The reason why that's an issue for the town is that the break-even point for these turbines is 16 hours of operation. But under this court order, they've agreed to do this. The case then continues to move forward. They're hoping that the judge did say that the neighbors there was some damage to them. And now he's encouraging both sides to continue to negotiate what the settlement's going to be and how to resolve this. This is pretty amazing, though, if I might opine here, because as you remember, just a year ago, they had this mediation between all sides and couldn't come up with any agreement. you know, a pretty formalized thing. And it really was even difficult to get people to come to the table for this agreement, the mediation. Mm-hmm. And so it's an interesting development.
Okay. We're going to go now to Tim Wood. He's the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Morning, Sean.
Tim, tell us about this, the Chatham Airport. We've talked about this quite a number of times. There's a skydiving operation there at Chatham Airport that has upset neighbors of the airport. And now, I don't know, is this a resolution here? What's happening?
It's not quite a resolution. It's sort of a next step in the evolution, I think, of this situation. You know, of course, as you mentioned, all summer long, the skydiving operation from Chatham Airport has caused a maelstrom of controversy with a group of residents who insist that it's unsafe and unsuitable for Chatham because of the density around the airport. A few weeks ago, the selectmen agreed to that and indicated that they wanted skydive out of the airport after its current contract expires this month. And renewal of that contract is contingent upon the Airport Commission and the town manager's approval. And this week, town manager Jill Goldsmith indicated that she, based on the selectman's position, she will not approve renewal of that contract. But this is far from the end of the story. Under Federal Aviation Administration regulations, skydiving is an allowed use at a small airport like Chatham's, with two narrow exemptions, and Goldsmith has instructed town council to pursue those exemptions with the FAA. But the manager of the airport indicated to us this week that loss of the operation, the skydiving operation, is going to mean loss of revenue not only for skydiving but for his company, which is actually the one that contracts with the skydiving operation. And he expects that if the town follows through on this position, that there will be possibly some legal action there.
Okay.
And it's interesting because we find that there's a split in the community over this, with opponents of the skydiving issue seeing it as an issue of peace and tranquility and property values, and others in town see this as another step towards Chatham becoming controlled by outside interests, by people from outside who are not exactly business friendly. It looks to us that, like, if legal action does happen, this could come down to perhaps a town meeting vote for funding of a legal fight, and that'll really bring it out into the open as far as a wider debate in the community about whether we should have skydiving continue.
When you say outsiders, what do you mean?
People who have bought homes here in the last, 10, 15 years maybe, or even less. A number of the people who are in the group that is leading the charge against skydiving, they live near the airport, but they've purchased their homes, many of them fairly recently. Mm-hmm. The airport's been there since the 1930s.
Right.
If you're going to buy a home within the proximity of the airport, if you don't know that, then there's a little bit of caveat emptor that comes into play here. And there's a wide group of people in town who feel that way, who feel that, hey, you bought near the airport, you got to put up with it.
Right. Okay, I understand. Tell me about Harwich. There is an effort to brand Harwich, but in a certain way to attract visitors, I imagine. But there are concerns from business owners in Harwich about just what that branding would be.
Sure. Yeah. The branding is all the rage these days as local towns try to distinguish themselves to capture a piece of that ever-shrinking tourist dollar, or fracturing tourist dollar, I should say. And the Harwich Chamber of Commerce right now is in the process of selecting a consultant to conduct a branding study of the town using funds that were allocated at town meeting last spring. The study is expected to take about a year, according to Chamber Director Jeremy Gingras. But what may be a complicating factor here for Harwich is that Harwich is composed of seven separate villages, and each of those villages wants its own identity. And recently, business owners who are trying to develop a plan to raise the profile of the Harwich Center Village worried that this branding campaign could kind of leave them out, especially if it focuses on the more better-known or commercial areas like Harwich Port and East Harwich. So they're hoping to get together a steering committee to develop an initiative not only for Harwich Center, kind of modeled after something that Orleans did about a dozen years ago, but they're also hoping that this group can work with the chamber on the overall town branding project, just to ensure that their village isn't left behind in this process.
Okay, understood. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you very much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. Take care.
You too. And Brennan, tell me about the this story was remarkable about this woman who was swept out to sea out in Provincetown.
Right. If I just may add something on the Wolf story, he said he plans to run for re-election as a senator. Just wanted to put that out there.
We spoke about Senator Dan Wolf before Tim Wood was on the phone and about the ethics decision there.
Right.
Sure.
Just wanted to mention that.
Yep.
Going back to this unfortunate situation, a New Yorker, Donna Pulaski, who has a timeshare apparently on Cape Cod, was this weekend walking along the beach at Race Point when she apparently dropped her glasses. She bent down to when a wave hit her, she dropped her glasses. She bent down to pick them up, and another wave came and swept her out. This is according to the chief ranger, Leslie Reynolds. That initiated a 911 call and a search by rescuers on foot from the air and from boats. And about 35 minutes after she was reported missing, she was found about her body was found about 2.5 miles away near Race Point Lighthouse.
Wow. And it was, the water was about, 57 degrees? I mean, this was a pretty quick response, and yet nothing they could do.
And also, but the seas were 4 to 6 feet.
Yeah.
And the natural seashore beaches have a really quick drop-off, and of the sand drops off quickly, which creates that undertow. And according to her hometown newspaper, relatives said that she did not like to swim.
Oh.
And in situations like this, relaxing is your best option to kind of just ride it through and try to get surfaced again and then swim diagonally to the riptide or whatever tide is carrying you out so that you can get yourself out of that pull.
Right.
And I don't want to speculate, but, she may have been very fearful if she didn't like to swim.
Right. Yeah. Panic could have set in. Who knows?
Right.
Let's move on to politics. And briefly, I want to just mention the results of the Barnstable Town Council election. Everyone was up for re-election this time on the council if they chose, because they reshuffle the council after every census.
Right. But not everybody faced an opponent.
Yeah.
One person who won was a realtor, James Crocker, who lost his seat in the last elections. He won it back by about 75 votes. And radio personality Will Crocker.
Two Crockers, huh?
Right. Two Crockers on the board. Beat former Hyannis Chamber of Commerce CEO Deborah Converse. And Thomas Rugo fell to a professional, to Eric Steinhilber in his race. And also the town was the 15th town to approve a non-binding question that directs the governor to ask that the NRC shut down Pilgrim Nuclear Power Plant. And so every town has voted on that. It's non-binding, but every town has directed the governor to make that request.
Every town on the Cape. You might not know this. Has Plymouth voted on that? Do you know?
I actually don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I'm going to find that out for next time we talk about Pilgrim, which will probably be next Friday. Let's talk about this zoning board in, I believe it's in Dennis, in South Dennis, and concerns about the harbor there and north and one of the marinas there in the harbor, which is just growing bigger and bigger. The selectmen waded in, or the zoning, who waded in on that? How'd
the
that
Dennis
work out?
Zoning Board of Appeals upheld the building commissioner's determination that most of the north side operations had been allowed without special permission because the town marina uses or because of they were town marina uses or long-time existing conditions that had expanded over time. This is a small neighborhood. I don't know where the Northside Marina is. It's a small road that comes down and then takes a very sharp kind of right turn, left turn. It's a small neighborhood, and people who live in that neighborhood say that marina owner Joe Buscone has been expanding the business there. He has a restaurant that he expanded to more than 200 seats. He's in created a dining cruise. I believe it's mainly for lunches that comes out of there. Then on top of that, there's storage of boats. There's the normal sale of boats, mm-hmm. the normal marina business. But they're saying that all this increased business and the expansion has created noise, bad odors, traffic jams, and parking problems, among other things. So they hired a lawyer, and they went to the Zoning Board of Appeals and said, he needs a special permit. Buscone should have been applying for special permits for this expansion. Like I said, the Zoning Board of Appeal didn't agree with this. And what's interesting about this is the first hearing of this was supposed to be held in August, but so many people, something like 150 people showed up for that hearing that they had to reschedule it. And which they did. The second venue was again too small because about 300 people showed up that time. And they then had this hearing this week. The residents felt that they were at an unfair advantage by this situation because a lot of people head to Florida. But there were, in fact, a lot of people. The supporters of the marina had yellow shirts and, you know, showed up in force. William Henchy, who represents the residents, mm-hmm. Says that they will likely appeal this in court.
Okay, let's move on to this story about the Mashpee Wampanoag and the intention to create a charter school with an effort to keep alive the Wampanoag language or revitalize it.
Revitalize it, right. There's an open house today, actually, at the Wampanoag Language Center on Falmouth Road, in which they will be talking about their intentions to open a charter school, a Wampanoag language immersion charter school that would open first to serve kindergartners and first grades, ultimately would go up to third grade. This is a movement that was started by Jesse Little Doe Baird, who... Mm-hmm. 10 or 20 years ago started trying. Her dream was to revitalize the native language of the Wampanoag tribal people. And she went to MIT. She used writings that mainly missionaries and other people had translated the language, like the Bible and other things when they came during colonial days. And she went to those sources and learned the language herself. Now she wants to teach it to more people. They've actually been able, she won a MacArthur Genius Award and used some of that money to train teachers. They're up to 16 teachers now who could teach this language. And now they say they're ready to open the school and have the language be revitalized and live again among, well, a charter school is open, not, wouldn't be open just to Wampanoag children. You have to open them to everybody. But the goal is to get more people, Wampanoag people, speaking this language.
So there's a state application to go through, like any charter school?
Right. They have to have an outline to the state officials, I think in the winter time, January or something, and then around that time. And then in July, they have to file a more formal curriculum to the state education officials. And then at that point, they would find out after they apply for this school, a charter school.
Interesting. Okay. I don't know of anything like that in the Commonwealth. We have charter schools, but in terms of a specific language and revitalizing a language, it's a pretty exciting thing for the tribe.
Well, there are, I know Boston has an immersion Spanish, English immersion program,
uh-huh,
and they're
sure.
Probably all things like that, you know, more common languages, I should say. But Jesse Little Doe Baird said that she looked and saw that in Alaska and some other places, there are these types of schools and Hawaii where they, you know, are trying to revive the native languages. And that's what she's using as her model.
And you used to live in Hawaii, so you know all about that.
Yes.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to check in with Nelson Siegelman, find out how he did on his deer hunt, and also learn about what's happening with another radio station, WMVY.
We have changes coming to our weekday afternoons here on WCAI. The program, The Story, is ending production. so we're filling the 2 o'clock hour with some of the best of public radio. Mondays, you'll hear On the Media. Tuesdays, The Moth. Wednesdays, This American Life. Thursdays, Studio 360. And we wind up the week, as always, with Science Friday. That's beginning next week, afternoons from 2 to 3, here on WCAI.
I had a Gordon Setter, Fergus. And Fergus was about the most stubborn, most stupid dog I have ever had the good fortune to know.
Nantucketer Ted Anderson.
And Fergus and I were walking out by Tom Never's Head, and the jackrabbit turned up. And Fergus took off after the jackrabbit, and I said, haw, 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 dog. The jackrabbit was sort of cruising along, and Fergus would get close, and the jackrabbit would shift into high gear, gone. Fergus just kept going. The jackrabbit would slow down, and Fergus think he was getting somewhere, and the but Fergus didn't stop. He wore that jackrabbit down and caught it and killed it. I was astonished. I mean, I didn't think this could possibly happen. Otherwise, I would have called the dog in.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.
Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. When we discuss the top news stories of the week, I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Ann Brennan, the assistant managing editor for digital media at the Cape Cod Times and Cape Cod Online. Joining us on the phone is Nelson Siegelman. He's the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning, Sean.
I exposed to the world that you were out deer hunting this morning.
I know, so you're giving away my secret. I said I was at a meeting all morning.
With deer?
Well, I wish I'd had a meeting with deer. I got to watch some two does prance around, but lucky for them and unlucky for me, they didn't come close enough to afford a decent shot. But, you know, part of being out there is just being out there, and it was a nice morning, even though it was a little brisk.
Yes, it was a beautiful morning. Tell us about WMVY. There was a big announcement yesterday, and give us a little bit of background.
Well, yes, MVY announced that they're coming back to the airwaves. This is still a bit off. They don't expect to be back until sometime in the spring after they go through the various processes of getting on the air and acquiring a frequency, which is going to be less than what they had when they were on the air. For those people not familiar with it, the MVY's parent company sold the signal to WBUR, the NPR station from Boston, and so they lost their 92.7 spot on the FM dial. After that happened, the folks, the staff members, didn't want to see the radio station just disappear, so they began a fundraising campaign. They were successful. They raised $600,000 in a very short amount of time, and they began broadcasting on the Internet. And now they, at the time, they had pledged to try and return to the FM airwaves, and now it appears that they may be able to do that. They're going to purchase a local FM frequency, and if everything goes as they say it will, sometime this spring they expect to be broadcasting.
It's pretty low wattage on that frequency, but they think it's enough to cover the island?
Well, it's rated at 250 watts. Their old signal was a 3,000-watt signal, so it'll be interesting to see what type of coverage they actually can get.
And I should mention that as WMVY has been off the air, we've had a relationship with WMVY. They've been doing, I think, an hour local music show about once a month here on WCAI on Sunday nights through our Arts and Ideas program. So we'll continue to watch, see how this music channel moves forward. Let's talk about the Adult and Community Education of Martha's Vineyard. This group is going to Board of Selectmen and saying, hey, we need funding here.
Yes, they've been, it's called ACEMV, and they've been going to the various boards making a case suggesting that the selectmen place an article on the spring annual town meeting warrant that would provide some funding for ACEMV. They've been to Oak Bluffs, Edgartown, and Tisbury. They've, you know, I think they've received a sympathetic reaction, but certainly no pledges of support for a warrant article. There are a couple of things in the way of that. But what ASMV is saying is that without added money from some other source, they're not going to be able to continue to support the program lineup that they now have. We looked at this pretty closely. We looked at their budget, and pretty much what it comes down to is the woman that's been running the program, Lynn Ditchfield, is putting in the full-time hours, but she's only been getting part-time pay, and she needs support staff. The program has just grown, and what she's saying really is that she needs support from the wider community.
Yeah.
But we'll see where that goes. Certainly continuing education is important when you live on an island and you don't have a lot of ways to attend classes.
Is this the primary group, nonprofit group, that does continuing education on the island?
Yes, certainly. They have quite a lot of classes, and they're generally pretty busy. You know, part of this will probably spur an examination, though, of just where continuing education stands in terms of the larger constellation. Certainly now people can go online classes. That didn't exist really 10 years ago. So it's
true.
Just a changing landscape, and hopefully they'll be able to work something out, because certainly a lot of people appreciate the offerings.
Okay, Nelson Sigmund, thank you very much. Nelson is the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. You can go and find the paper online, read these stories and more. Thanks, Nelson.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Ann Brennan, she's in the studio with me in Woods Hole, and she's with the Cape Cod Times. And one of the stories that we've been talking about over the past year or so is the Calvary Baptist Church, which burned in March of 2012. But what a community effort to get things rebuilt, and a big progress this week.
Right. Big progress in the last 2 months, actually. It's gone from a foundation to a framed, roofed, enclosed building that yesterday the steeple was placed on top of. It's a 27-foot-tall steeple, and they're really working hard, I hope, in the next 2 weeks to have the siding and doors installed so that it's weather-tight and they can start working on the inside of the building. This effort has been paid for by insurance from the original fire, but also in a large part on the kindness of several businesses, which have provided labor and materials at discounted costs. So it's really helping. The church is trying to raise about $467,000 for the effort. They've raised about $32,000, so those efforts continue.
Remind me, if you recall, what caused the fire?
The fire was caused by a overheated extension cord that had been a little frayed. The Calvary Baptist Church had participated in the Knights of Hospitality, which was a way to help serve the homeless community. If the shelter filled up, a lot of the churches came together, you might recall.
Yes.
And they would let the Calvary Baptist Church also had a soup kitchen. They were providing meals for many people. So this was a huge problem after the fire happened. And this new building has a special section for a soup kitchen, actually. So
has the congregation been meeting since?
The congregation has been meeting in the Federated Church of Hyannis in the basement.
Right.
But they have had a drop off in attendance because it's really been hard to keep it going. So the hope is that once the church is built and is operational, people will come back. But it held much more than a spiritual meaning to this community. You know, of course, spiritually it is the most important, but carrying out the mission of helping people who are down on their luck or not doing as well as others and need help.
Right. Let's talk about the Cape Playhouse. And we told you earlier this year that they had lost their artistic director, and now they've got a new one.
Right.
And he's got a lot of responsibility.
Right. Yes. Evans Hale decided, after 14 years, decided he was going to step down from the position. And Mark Cuddy, who has been the CEO for 18, artistic director and CEO for 18 years for the Jiva Theater Center in Rochester, New York, approached the Cape Playhouse folks aboard and said, I'd be interested in this job. And he's now not only going to be running the Cape Playhouse, but he's the chief executive of the all the buildings. There's a restaurant and other buildings. It's a Cape Cod Arts Center. And he will be charged with not only running, being the artistic director of the Cape Playhouse, but also trying to align the vision of all the businesses that are on that campus and really try to revitalize even more the plays and collaborate with other Giva, for one thing, to make it a more vibrant place.
That's what wasn't clear to me. So he's going to retain his position with Giva in Rochester, New York?
Yes.
And then presumably spend most of his summertime here.
Right. They're opposite. The Giva runs like in the winter months.
Ah, right.
The fall and winter. Cape Playhouse is spring and summer. You might see productions that are at Giva come to be in Dennis. So there's going to be some collaboration there. I know a Giva production of Avenue Q at this time last year was playing at Cape Rep Theater.
Oh, they were doing the Avenue Q.
Right.
That's the one with the puppets.
Right.
Oh, that's quite a show.
I actually saw it. It was fun. But he's very much in a collaborative mode. He's a Massachusetts native. He grew up in Dorchester and Jamaica Plain. I think he wanted to come back to Massachusetts. But
who can blame him?
Right.
Okay. I really want to get to this story about this sandwich teenager who found some money right around Halloween, or maybe it was Halloween. And I pointed this story out to my son as kind of a lesson in, you know, when you find something that's not yours, what
right.
do you do?
Well, Jack Sheehan was walking his dog and he saw a couple of bags in the middle of the street, went over to investigate them, found some candy and about $1,200 worth of money in a deposit bag. And he called his mom and said, "What should I do?" And she said, "Well, is anyone around?" And he said, "No." She says, "Well, bring it home." So he did. They brought it to the police. It wasn't obvious whose it was. They brought it to the police, and the police were able, through the deposit slips, were able to find the owner and return the money.
And it was a local business?
It was the Mashpee Country Store
mm-hmm.
owner. And we spoke to his brother, and the brother was saying, you know, you can forget when you've lost money, but you'll always remember when somebody returns it. And so the Jack Sheehan's mother said, I think 99% of people would have done this, but a lot of people got a lot of comments on our Facebook page. That's for sure, that people
people love these stories.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I was watching the TV trucks come down from Boston
right.
in order to jump on your story. This young man made the front page of the newspaper for his good deed. And as I said, it's a great story to share with folks. That's it. That's what's happening. Ann Brennan, the assistant managing editor for digital media, joined me today in our Woods Hole studio. And Ann, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And great thanks to Josh Balling of the Inquirer and Mirror on Nantucket, Sally Rose of the Provincetown Banner, Tim Wood called in from the Cape Cod Chronicle, and we heard from Nelson Siegelman, fresh from his deer hunt, from the Martha's Vineyard Times. I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.
The Friday News Roundup on The Point is produced by Sean Corcoran. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.